He's quickly going to gavel us out.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Friday afternoon in the House Committee of Transportation and Economic Development. We have three bills and one work session. We're going to start the work session on House Bill 2310. This is Connect Oregon. And Troy, if you want to give us a little reminder, we can ask Betsy if you'd like to come up or someone else from ODOT help us understand the amendment that is in front of us.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2310, relating to financing of transportation projects, promotes states' economic development, broadens Connect Oregon's focus on non-highway transportation to include bicycle and pedestrian projects, authorize issuance of $100 million in lottery bonds for transportation projects funded by multimodal transportation funds, specifies use of lottery bond proceeds, creates five county regions to fund allocation of at least 10% of net proceeds, declares emergency effective July 1st, 2013. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are in possession of the required paperwork from fiscal and revenue. We are in possession of the Dash 2 amendments, and we also have Heidi Elliott from Legislative Council with us today to maybe summarize the amendments.
Is she here?
Yes, she is.
Oh, she's hiding in the back. Heidi, I didn't see you there. Yes, if you could please help us understand how the Dash 2 amendments work. And is there anyone from ODOT who wants to join?
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. The Dash 2s.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Elliott, and I'm an attorney with the Office of Legislative Counsel. I'm here today to walk you through the Dash 2 amendments, starting with changes to Section 3, which just realigns the counties with the regions that ODOT has currently with the Connect Oregon regions. Currently, they don't really align, and now we've just moved one county into a different region, and now they all match up. Then going on to Section 4, which two big things are going on here. We're going to allow bicycle and pedestrian projects to be a part of Connect Oregon, and we're also changing Connect Oregon from a grant and loan program to just a loan program. Then in Section 5, we see that the amount of the loans can't exceed 80% of the cost of the project. Now, there can be forgiveness of those loans if
and let me
you meet
just
certain conditions.
Back up for a second. Oh, there it is, Section 5. Sorry, I got it.
Yeah, Section 5,
yep.
Page 3.
Yep, thank you.
So subsection 3 says if you meet certain conditions, you can have up to 100% of your loan forgiven. And then we go on to Section 6. Which says that before the Oregon Transportation Commission selects projects, they will consult with, say, the Marine Board or Aviation Board. So they're going to, at this point, because we're adding Bike Ped, they're going to consult with the Bike Ped Advisory Committee for those projects. And we've also added two high priority considerations for the Oregon Transportation Commission to consider when they're selecting the projects. And finally, in Section 7, last session, ODOT was given authority to assist the Department of Aviation in their administrative duties. And so Section 7 sort of aligns the Connect Oregon piece with ODOT's new duties as they assist the Department of Aviation in administering aeronautic and airport transportation projects. And that, Chair and members of the committee, is your last two amendments.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Bohard, do you want to give us any sort of introduction to the amendments, and then we can make sure that the committee understands how they work and how you would administer them?
Good afternoon. For the record, Jerry Bohard, TDD Division Administrator, Chair Reed, and committee members. These amendments, we pretty much still follow the process that we have in place for the Connect Oregon process. We would now add an additional modal committee for review. We would need to make some changes to the application process, as well as the information that we provide to the applicants. But from a process standpoint, we don't see there would be any changes. We would have to make some changes to the administrative rule. We would need to define kind of the definition of what what would be a with regards to the loan, so what it would mean to meet the project delivery standards, what it would mean to meet the performance measures, because there isn't necessarily a list of statewide projects, we would need to define what that is in the administrative rule as well. So what is being proposed here would require, again, changes to the administrative rule and then changes to all of our documentation, nothing that couldn't be done. I think the one comment I would have is with some of these changes, it may take a little bit longer to do the administrative rule and get all of the pieces together. Obviously, the other key one is, as with a loan process, the intergovernmental agreements that we do with each of the applicants would be more one-to-one, and so those would probably take a little bit longer to do before they would actually move forward. So logistic-wise, we may extend the time a little bit, but again, not something that couldn't be overcome. So be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Doherty.
So under the loan section, before there were grants and loans, and so have the grants pretty much gone away and it's now strictly a loan process?
Chair Reed, Representative Doherty, yes, but it would be, in a sense, what we call a forgivable loan process. So, and for the local governments, automatically, the 37% of 80, which is essentially 30% of their overall project, would automatically be forgiven because they were a public entity.
Okay. Thank you.
Additional questions? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the section 3 subs A, B, and C, where it talks about how much of the loan can be forgiven under certain conditions, each one of them is subject to, well, not each one, B and C are subject to something that's going to be described by rule, administrative rule that the department will follow up on. Are there already some preliminary lists of ideas that the department would be working on to help guide what those rules might be?
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson, actually both B and C are something that we currently do within our agreements that we do with applicants, put in milestones relative to development and construction, and under Connect 4 was really the first time we put forward performance measures within the agreement. So yes, we do definitely have some very good examples that we would probably be able to fairly easily roll into the administrative rule.
Yes, please. And the administrative rulemaking process is one for which there is some public involvement, is that correct? And legislative awareness, so that if we wanted to observe the process as it was, as those rules are being formulated, we could watch.
So, Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson, yes, there is a, the Secretary of State actually has an official rules process, and it does have within it a public hearing process, also has notifications to stakeholders, and ultimately would be approval by the Transportation Commission. So, and then depending on the rule, whether or not an advisory committee or a stakeholder group is involved, again, depending on that would obviously increase the timing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Betts.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, these questions are, I think, for Heidi. But the first one has to do with the addition of the two new categories that are allowed for investment, bicycle and pedestrian. And I just want to go back to the bill itself. And the original portion of the bill, which I think still survives the amendment, calls out a need for the, all of these projects to support, create jobs, and further economic development in the state. Am I correct in understanding that if a bicycle or pedestrian investment was called out, it would still have to meet those requirements?
Chair Reed, Representative Benz, that's correct.
Follow up, please.
Then I am unclear. I think you may have said that the loan could be, 100% of the loan could be forgiven, or did I misunderstand that?
If you're a public, Chair Reed, Representative Benz, yes, if you're a public body, you could have up to 100% of your loan forgiven.
Can you take us through that? Because I don't see that here. Can you explain how that works under this language?
So, Chair Reed, Representative Benz, If you add up 37.5, 25, and 37.5, that equals 100% of the 80% of the monies. So you can only get 80% of your project cost, but if you meet A, B, and C, then you can have all of that forgiven.
I'll break in all of the 80, you mean? Is that right?
All of the 80.
Yes.
If I may, Mr. Chair. So it says 37.5% of the money's lent.
Yes.
So the money's lent would be 80% of the project.
Yes.
So you'd still, you'd have your 20% you still put in, obviously. That's not going to be forgiven. That's your money. So it'd be 80% of the total cost of the project. But 37.5, 25, and 37.5, the idea is that you would end up with 100% no cost if you were public. If you were a private, what's that add up to then?
80. Chair Reed, Representative Benz, yes. That's correct.
That adds up to the 80, so that's 100 of 80. So these are, these A, B, and C are subservient to the B, the 80% in B above, I think.
Why don't you give, if I may?
Yes, please.
Why don't you give us an example? Use some numbers and so we can follow, because I'm still confused. Not surprisingly. Use a $100,000 project.
Chair Reed, Representative Bent. So I think what's, don't want to get lost in this is that, so 20% is matched. That's already, that whether you're a private entity or a local government, that you need to provide for every project. So a local entity would only get 80% at the most of its project forgiven. So similar to what they currently
have. If I may, $100,000 project. Just take us through it.
And so for a $100,000 project, if you were a private entity, then 20% you'd be providing as your match. And then ultimately, 50,000 would never... you would be responsible for. So a private entity would be responsible for 50% of the cost of the project, 20% being the match, and then the other additional 30%, the fact that they're not a public entity. So in the case of a $100,000 project, they would have a $50,000 loan that could be forgiven, provided they met the milestones for project delivery and the performance measure that had been established in the agreement.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm still going to be confused on this. It might be a good idea if you could give us a written example, take us through it at some point, and give us a public and a private one. Then we'd know for sure how this works, or at least I would, how it works. Another question, Mr.
Chair. Sure.
On page 4 of the amendment, there is a... I think, Heidi, you referred to high priority. I think you used the word high priority. Can you tell me where that high priority part, why is it high priority? Because I don't see the word high there.
Yes. Chair Reed, Representative Benz, you actually need to look on page 5, subsection 4. And it says, when selecting transportation projects, the Commission shall give priority to the considerations described in subsection 3 and B of this section. 3A and 3B of the section.
I see. So the, if I may, so the idea is calling that out again. This, there is a requirement that great consideration be given to the fact that it's a statewide transportation priority. And I think Jerry mentioned that we don't have that list yet of statewide projects. How, I guess the question would be, how would we know that it is, it falls within that statewide transportation priority category?
Chair Reed, Representative Bent, that would have to be defined through the administrative rule process. For instance, I don't know that there is a list that exists for marine projects. We certainly, from a bike ped standpoint, we go through applications, and there's always, the need is always greater than the amount of funds that we may have, but to have them actually identified as statewide, we would probably do some definition that talks about whether or not it was identified within a modal plan. Like in the case of aviation, I do believe that they've done a capital improvement program that really identifies their statewide priorities. It might be going back to a local government's transportation system plan. So that would be kind of the work that we would need to do. I admit to being pretty unfamiliar with kind of the marine planning process. I know most of the ports have done a master plan. Whether or not they identify projects within all of their master plans, I don't know the answer to that.
And then my last question. The loan, I don't want to assume, but I would hope it would be a secured loan, secured by something, and then there would be an interest rate on the loan. How would those elements of the loan be established?
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, that's exactly why each of the interlocal IGAs that we would do with the applicants would have to be unique, because we would have to identify what their security is. I can't speak to what the loan percentage would be. That's kind of out of my bailiwick. So I apologize for that.
But if I hear you correctly, that is something that would be included in each of the agreements. We don't know exactly what it would be, but something would be there.
Chair Reed, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. I want to go back and follow the money a little bit here. Try to walk through an example so that we can get it on the record and understand it. So let's imagine a public entity project that costs $125,000. 80% of that, so there has to be an initial $25,000 public match. That's 20% of the project. 80% left is $100,000. If it's a public entity, and at any point, step in and tell me I'm wrong, or right, the end. We're at $100,000 now. Because it's a public entity, $37,500 is immediately forgiven under sub A, 3A. $25,000 would then be forgiven if the project meets project delivery standards. And then the final $37,500 would be forgiven if the recipient demonstrates that the project meets performance measures established by rule. Is that correct?
Representative Davis, yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Okay. For a private entity now, a project that is worth initially $125,000, they have to match $25,000, 20% to start out with. They don't get the initial $37,500, but they can have up to $25,000 forgiven if the recipient meets project delivery standards, and another $37,500 forgiven if the recipient demonstrates the project meets performance measures?
Chair Reed, Representative Davis, that would be correct.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. Following the money further, sorry, follow up, please. Following money further, currently those project performance and delivery standards are part of the agreement with either the public or private entity. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, follow up. Why are we now making it by rule? That's a question I have, because it seems rulemaking has the force of law, and I'm wondering if you feel it's possible, if there might be some difficulty to create performance standards in law as opposed to in each one of those contracts. I'm just confused about how that would work.
Chair Reed, Representative Davis, I think while they're certainly within each of the agreements, I think certainly being more clear about the expectations. We work very hard to make sure the milestones are met when we work with the applicants, but sometimes as the application comes forward, they're over-ambitious about the milestones or over-ambitious about what they think the performance measures will be, you know, how many jobs will be created and so on and so forth. So I believe that by putting this into the legislation and being more clear about the legislature being very interested in these numbers, you're going to get some more clarity as to exactly what the milestones will be and what the performance metrics the applicants believe that they can meet based on the project that they're bringing forward.
Okay. Thank you.
You're good. Questions? Representative Bentz.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. So this is different than what we have now. Do you anticipate less enthusiasm for the program, or more, or the same? Give us a wild guess.
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, it would be a very wild guess. I think probably for the public entities, it will require a little bit more homework and a little bit more justification as they put together their application, but I believe that the need is there and they'll continue to go forward. It's hard for me to know with regards to some of the private entities as to how those will come together. I think, you know, they were always doing a 20% match. Now it may be going up to a 50% match. I think depending on the private entity, some will be able to find those funds, others not. And then I guess their willingness to secure a loan is probably a different, you know, another threshold that they'll have to determine individually.
That's actually helpful. Given the fact that we're just speculating as to what they might do, the interesting part is going to be the terms of the loan and the security the department will be asking for the loan. Just reflecting on the nature of some of these improvements, a railroad, for example, or something of that nature, it's hard to see how a mortgage is going to be taken on that without the involvement of the railroad. It's an interesting challenge. I did have a question. I wasn't quite clear on the Oregon Department of Aviation and being brought into the cooperation piece found on page 5. Was that what is the thinking there, that their involvement, the Department of Aviation, would be of assistance in those loans involving aviation? Is that why they're being brought in?
And Chair Reed, Representative Vance, this is actually how we've been doing the Connect process with the Department of Aviation. So this really just solidifies that financial relationship. So it really did not have anything to do with the loan program. It's more just the relationship that we have with the Connect and the selection of aviation projects.
Right, and a follow-up.
Please.
And there is may use monies from the fund to pay the administrative costs. Was that because there was no, in the past, they had to go find that money from some other source, and now they would be allowed to access this program for those funds?
Chair Reed, Representative Metz, that's correct, and we had more we being ODOT, had more responsibility for the aviation projects, and now the oversight of the aviation projects would move to be more clearly defined as moving over to the aviation responsibilities.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay. I think we're ready.
Senator Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2310.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2310. Discussion on the motion? Any objections? I don't see any. Motion carries. The -2 amendments are adopted. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2310 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2310 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation and that the bill be referred on to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion of the motion. Representative Leibman.
Mr. Chair, I'm not trying to bog this down, but I have a personal problem with using lottery dollars to repay bonds. And so it's hard for me to separate out, and I understand I'm not against this program, it's hard for me to separate out when I go to looking at how we use state resources. And I understand that's not our responsibility here, but when I'm taking action on any particular bill that seems to be reinforcing a certain behavior, then I have a concern with that. And so from my standpoint, and this isn't because I'm against the lottery, but I am, I just don't think, I don't personally think when we're making these decisions, and then if we look at the overall needs for the state government and how we fund things, that this is an appropriate use of those lottery dollars that we're raising. I think those lottery dollars should be going to the causes we originally intended them to go to, and we've diluted that a lot. So from my standpoint, I'm in favor of this program. I'm just not in favor that the lottery is the best way to repay these bonds.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think these changes to the program are positive, and I think the urgency element that's been added in is good. My area probably isn't enthusiastic about the bicycle or pedestrian piece, but I understand others are. I would say that the $100 million is too much for my taste for this, but I'm going to support it because it'll go to Ways and Means. I'll make my make sure my folks there understand that I think that's a little high. But I do believe moving toward a loan program is a good thing, and I'm happy for those for the urgency change, the loan change, and the statewide transportation priority change.
Thank you.
Comments? Yep. Representative Campbell. Mr. Chair, I'll probably echo those. Just the accountability piece in here of coming back to report that we're actually getting the results that we set out to do is a really good about this thing, and we have seen over a period of several bienniums this program working well, but now we're putting some accountability into it, which I think is a good idea.
Thank you. I would just make two quick comments, both of which have been alluded to already. I want to be clear that I think the intent of adding bicycle and pedestrian is that those modes can compete. Not that they are going to have any guaranteed outcome, but that they have a chance to make their case on an equal basis with the other modes. I'm reminded of the bill we heard from Representative Wisnett and the picture we saw. We joked about people running across a highway and the notion that there might somewhere in the state be a bike or pedestrian project that would accrue to the benefit of some of these other modes, making freight or other things safer and faster. The other is, as has been mentioned, our bill says $100 million. The governor's budget has $60 million. Whatever the number turns out to be, that will be decided in ways and means against all of the other needs of the state. But I think we are sending a message in this committee that we value this program, that it has an important place. As much as I understand Representative Bence's concerns, I have people in my part of the world who would like it to be much bigger. So we'll let that sort itself out in the Ways and Means Committee. With that, if there isn't any more, no more discussion, Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm just really disappointed you didn't accept my amendment to toll the bike projects.
Representative Cameron, thank you. Is there any other more comments? Are there any objections to the motion? I don't see any. Motion carries. House Bill 2310 goes to the floor and on to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Yes, please. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2310. And we're going to stand at ease for just a moment while we invite Representative Olson to come up for his bill. He's just next door. And we're back on the record. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2406. Welcome, Representative Olson. While you get settled, we'll ask Troy to give us a quick summary on the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2406-1 provides that person does not commit offense of obstruction of vehicle windows by reason of placement of signs in windows of vehicle. Confirmed signs placed in windows of vehicle shall not prevent or impair the ability to see out of the vehicle.
Thank you for your patience, Representative Olson. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm a member from House District 15, representative down there in Albany. And this bill, House Bill 2406, I just got to kind of give you a little bit of heads up. You have a letter in front of me, but I'm just going to kind of give you a little bit of life experience, too, that I saw over the past 20-some years when this bill first came into effect. Or the law came into effect for window tinting. I was a brand new station commander with state police out of the Beaverton office on Allen Boulevard near Highway 217. And I see, Chair, you might okay, so obviously.
Near my house, yes.
Don't remember chasing you down,
sir. Not him. I mean,
he would have had to. Yeah.
But
I'm not sure I was, I think I was probably here in college at that point, maybe. But.
Oh, that's disappointing. Okay. So, well, anyways, Well, we get up there, and you know, the legislature just passed this bill, a new statute regarding the window tinting law. And a lot of the members in my office, the troopers, were kind of struggling understanding really what this was all about because of the density of the tinting that was going on out there. And there was a lot of that in cars, especially up in the Beaverton area, with their vehicles that they had. So I invited a member from Department of Motor Vehicles that was on the enforcement team to come up one day, and we were very nice about stopping vehicles out on Allen Boulevard and out on 217 and asked them if they would voluntarily come on in so we could measure what their density was on their window. Gave us an opportunity as troopers to see really what the violation was that we were looking for, because we didn't quite understand. Point being is that the clarity that we were trying to seek, we struggled with, and to this day, we still kind of struggle with it. Okay, so I've been removed from being a police officer for nearly 10 years now, but we still have this problem with the definition and what's happening with the clarity of the statute. For example, I've talked to a number of law enforcement agencies down there in the Mid-Valley, how they would enforce an issue, and then what they do possibly with Salem Police Department, which I have identified in my letter to you. There's clearly just a difference of what's going on. This bill just kind of brings a little bit of clarity. You should have a photograph, I think, and Art Meeker, and before I go any further, I should give you an exercise here on the letter that I sent you. Rather than on the third paragraph that starts out with Art Meeks, it's actually Meeker. All right, so
we have that on our sign-up sheets. We have it right there.
Thank you, kindly. And if you would just correct that the rest of the way through, I appreciate that. What this statute does is just, it kind of brings a little bit more clarity. It would allow this type of tinting to occur on a vehicle that you have in front of you right now.
Wilson, can I interrupt for just a second?
Yes.
And ask you to move the microphone a little closer? I'm getting the word that the folks out in the...
Is that better?
Yeah, probably. So it's fine for me, but the folks, the thousands of people who are listening made it on the internet are not able to hear you very well, so I want to make sure they have the same pleasure that we do. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm honored. Thank you. So anyways, bottom line is that you're seeing what's happening here. Art Meeker is going to be coming up sharing with you what happened with him recently. Actually, a couple years ago. This has been a two-year journey for us. And I appreciate also Amy Joyce from Motor Vehicles, because she's kind of been involved in helping us too. And again, she's been involved from the get-go 2 years ago. And we actually looked at this issue 2 years ago and chose not to go there at that time and then to pursue it now this time. They can help you a little bit more and understand this and paint this picture of what this bill does. I do want to mention that the Dash 1's amendments is where we want to go to fix what the original bill was.
Very good. Are there questions for Representative Olson? Representative Lively.
Well, Representative Olson, the original intent had to do with safety. Is that correct? That's why the law was originated?
Yeah. Chair Reed, Representative Lively, from what I recall back in 1989, that it was designed for safety issue. And because when you have the 35% light transmittal portion of what the law says regarding it, if you measure that and then you understand what that means, that does help quite a bit for what you're seeing in and out. But more so, when you look at the other states right now that do not have a law that deals with this, for example, Florida, Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, because of the sun, they don't have that. But then they have the sun, too. I'm not saying that we don't have the sun here. It is when you have less than 35% and you're out there at night with it, I mean, that's hard to see through.
Just one more quick. One more question, given your experience as a police officer. So the tinting and walking up then to these cars that have tinted windows, I'm just trying to understand again from the safety and how this is connected, how that works.
Well, okay, the Chair Reed and Representative Lively, I think initially everybody's thinking, or at least I thought this initially, that it was designed for the safety of law enforcement to come up on a vehicle. It was the safety of the driver being able to see out more so than it was. But be truth with you, there is an issue there for approaching a vehicle. I mean, it causes you to kind of have to pay a little bit more attention when you have a darker tinted window. You really do.
Representative Doherty.
Representative Olson, with the pictures that you have, what do they depict? In other words, does this picture show, is this out of this window, or what? I'm not quite understanding what your pictures are.
Yeah, Chair Reed and Representative Doherty, Art Meeker can come up here and explain that to you, because he took those photos, and he can identify that a little bit better than what I could.
To tinting, which we normally associate with how dark something would be, I've noticed that statutes, whether it's Oregon or other states, also refer to reflectivity. Is that ever related to the issue you're raising with us right now?
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson, no. But again, you're going to have Amy Joyce up here too. She might be a better one for you to ask that question to. And just before I leave that, your bill that we passed earlier this week was a good bill for a fix-a-ticket concept. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering why the rear window had been removed from the application of the law. It says this subsection only applies to the following windows of the vehicle: the front, the side wings, the side windows on either side, forward or adjacent to the operator, and then the rear window has been taken out.
Right. Yeah, Chair Reed and Vice Chair Benz, I think what you're going to hear from Art Meeker on this whole issue is the difference between having a vehicle that has a closed panel where there's no window at all in the back versus that of having this type of a design on it that you're seeing here is similar. I mean, for the concept of not being able to see in. So that was kind of the idea.
Questions? Thank you. You're welcome to stick around, or if you are needed as you're in your other role,
excuse you.
Thank you very much. The other two people who have signed up are the aforementioned Art Meeker and Amy Joyce. If you'd both like to join us, appreciate it. Meeker, maybe you can go first and give us your story and help us understand the pictures.
The way the work.
And I need you to start with your name, please.
Okay, Arthur Meeker.
Thank you.
So this came about a couple of years ago. Our company van, and we're issued a citation for it, and doing a lot more checking into it and asking local law enforcement down in Albany in the Mid-Willamette Valley, asking about that, and they really didn't have a problem with the graphics on the vehicle. It's a commercial vehicle, and it's used for business and not personal. So I, did some checking around on it, and then it was really concerning to me because vehicles, as I was looking at vehicles that are on the road, you have a pickup truck that can haul a load of wood in the back of it, and you can't see in the back window. You have a conversion van has curtains hanging on the back windows. Can't see in it. We have another company vehicle that's a truck, and it's an Isuzu cab over. It has a back window, but it has a cube on the back of it, and you can't see in the back window at all. Then you also have factory vehicles that come, SUVs that come with dark tinted windows, and you can't see in those tinted windows at all. and those come right directly from the factory. The other thing that concerned me about it is I also saw several government vehicles that had headache racks and toolboxes in the back, and you couldn't see in the back. The law's very, very unclear how they determine what's legal and what's not legal. With the window, I saw that you guys have the picture of the vehicle that has the window film on it that I'm talking about. That's a side picture of a vehicle because that was just happened to be the vehicle that I had at the time to take a picture of and to pass it on to Mr. Olson. The graphics on the outside is the digitally printed graphics. Some people don't like to put the graphics on their vehicle on the paint surface. And there's other ones that they want to do the whole vehicle, and going over the windows completes the graphics. It's an affordable way for businesses to advertise their company, and with the economic times the way they are, sometimes it's pretty difficult to come up with a budget to advertise your business. With that picture, it shows a picture from the inside that it's a very unobstructed view of out the back window of the vehicle. When you can see out of it.
This is the same window, the first
same
one looking
window, yep.
At it from the outside and then looking out it from the inside?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Also the proper way to install it. I mean, there's a couple ways you can do it. The proper way is to put a lamination over the top of it, and that keeps the weather off of it too and stuff like that. So, but basically what the bill is so we can get a little bit more clarity on the graphics for Windows.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Meeker, thank you. So is this the rear window, or this is the side rear window?
That would be a side rear window. That particular vehicle did not have any graphics on the back window.
Okay, they didn't cite you for this. They cited you for the back window.
Yeah, this isn't actually our company vehicle. The picture that you have, this is a picture of a customer's vehicle that we just happened to have in the shop, so we can, and I needed to take some pictures to show Mr. Olson what I was talking about.
So, again, for clarity, so this is the picture. So you can really see out of the back when you've got this on there.
Yep, that's exactly the same.
It's almost better than my dirty window, than my dirty
exactly.
Back window that I have.
Probably. Today it's even worse.
No commentary on the fire representative. Joyce.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, Amy Joyce, Transportation. As Representative Olson indicated on this issue, since it may have been late in the 2011 session, just talking about this, and Mr. Meeker and Representative Olson was to have this only apply if you're advertising a business or something like that. The problem there is that the Oregon Constitution doesn't allow the restriction of what topic of the thing is that you're saying. And so saying that it's going to be advertising a business won't. Other things like if it's a one of the ideas that was proposed in the amendment to say just taking out that piece about the rear window so that it could be partly tinted. Another idea that was put forward was the type of material. So when you have these wraps like Mr. Meeker's business, you know, if you've got that type of material or the density that's made up of a bunch of little dots, you know, crafting language that would allow for that. So
The bill and the dash one is, again, trying to bring clarity and uniformity to the enforcement of this tinting law, and again, it's a difficult needle to thread. And so the dash one does precisely what you indicated, just, you know, takes out rear window from the requirement that you not have the tinting. And that's what the bill does.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Lively?
So when I read this, I'm very much in favor, and I understand what you're saying. You know, vehicle wraps have become a great thing in advertising. More and more, we wrap buses, we do all kinds of things. So it's always amazed me. But the way this reads, it says, prevents or impairs the ability to see into or out of the vehicle. And so the part that's confusing me is seeing into the vehicle. That's in the law. Because it appears to me, and I can tell you some of the vehicle wraps and things, there's no way in the world you can see in unless you get up there like this and look into it. So I'm just concerned about that portion of the law, if that doesn't still create a problem for what we're trying to accomplish.
Chair Reed and Representative Lively, and are you, if I may ask, are we talking about the base bill or the dash one?
The dash one.
Or either, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I would just continue to say it's a difficult needle to thread, nut to crack, whatever you want to say. It is challenging to figure out at what level is it, are we able to see out of the vehicle as the operator of the vehicle, and again, for law enforcement to see in. I would say that the department does not really have concerns with the dash one in terms of safety, if that's part of your question. And maybe I perhaps didn't fully understand the question.
You want to redirect?
Yeah, so first, I'm pretty comfortable inside because I've ridden a lot of these vehicles, and it's amazing me how well I can see out. But my concern is the law that says, again, and so my concern is about the seeing into the part that says see into the vehicle is what concerns me, because in many of these vehicles, I have to admit I've gone up and done like this to try to see in, just to see what's in there, and I don't know how close you'd have to be, so don't know how you would define that from a standpoint of enforcement, of being able to see in, because if the vehicle's driving down the road, you couldn't see into that vehicle the same way you can if the vehicle has no tinting or nothing on it. And so that's the part I don't understand is how, what defines that.
Chair Reed and Representative Lively, thank you for the clarification. I don't know that it's, you know, specifically defined anywhere. I think the concern about the ability to see in is not the driving down the road piece. It's exactly as Representative Olson indicated. Law enforcement is approaching a vehicle. They want to be able to see in to make sure there's not somebody, you know, ready to jump out or who knows what in the back. So I think the idea being, you know, close proximity, like you're talking about, can they see in for their own safety and in their law enforcement role?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that I think it's important for pedestrians, bicyclists, and other motorists to be able to see in to catch the eye of the driver.
Yes.
Especially if the vehicle is in motion or in a roadway, not just parked on the side.
Or about to be in motion,
or
maybe.
About to be in motion, yeah. Yeah, if it's on a roadway, as opposed to sitting in a parking lot,
right,
parked or something. But my question is, from a previous bill that this committee considered, there was a question about vehicle weight in the law. It seems like the law applies mostly to vehicles that you and I would be driving around and not big, heavy trucks. Maybe it excludes buses, for all I know. And so I'm trying to figure out if the wrapping, for example, in the commercial application of these other sorts of images, if it occurs mostly in vehicles that would be exempt anyway. I don't know.
Sorry, I actually was getting advice on something else, so I missed the last part. I wasn't sure if that's a question or rhetorical statement.
No, it's really a question to make sure I understand how it's going to work with exempt vehicles and where these wraps are found.
Got it. Okay.
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson, I have to say I don't know. I mean, I've certainly seen them on a wide variety of vehicles, and perhaps Mr. Meeker has a better idea of where, what kinds of vehicles or what kind of customer puts these on.
They, just about everything from little Scions, pickup trucks, buses, we've wrapped city buses, mm-hmm. All the way down. I don't know what would be exempt from that.
I don't have
by
a clear
exempt,
answer.
Do you mean a state-owned or a publicly owned vehicle? Is that what you mean?
The law, as I'm trying to recall it now, it exempts vehicles over a certain weight. So it's not supposed to apply to big commercial trucks, for example, and maybe buses aren't included.
Really
I just can't envision down to what size vehicle it applies anyway.
Okay.
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson, you're right that those bigger vehicles are exempt from this stuff. I think it is, you know, I'm going to have to get back to you on that in terms of what the exact exemption is. It's in a different ORS, and I don't have that in front of me, but I will get that information to you.
Thank you. Other questions? Let's see. Any last word from you, Mr. Meeker?
You made a comment about the eyesight and the line of vision from the driver, from a pedestrian. What we're talking about is the back of a vehicle right now, and usually people aren't going to be, you know, seeing from the back the pedestrian's eyes or the driver's eyes of a vehicle and see what their intent is. And so there, right now, the common vehicle out there is an SUV, and those come factory tinted, and they are already dark, and you barely can see the head of the person, the back of the head of the person that's in that vehicle already. And that's kind of a common vehicle to do graphics on, because it is a large large canvas on the side and the back. So that's one of the things that I would question about whether you're going to see somebody's eyes from the back of the vehicle.
It remains an issue, though. I think I take your point that that's a separate issue than what's in this bill.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, I just need to clarify, because what this refers to here is the only thing that's exempted was the back, but it talks about the front windshield, the side windows, and so on, which means any of those could be wrapped. Is that the way I read this? I don't know why.
Chair Reed and Representative Lively, it's a little bit in the negative. So it talks about that there can't be the obstruction or too dark of a tinting on the following windows: the front windshield, the side wings, the side windows forward or adjacent to the operator's seat. And what is in the current law is also the rear window. And so what the Dash 1 amendment to the bill would do then is it removes the rear window from having that no tinting or only so much of a tinting requirement.
In other words, the rear window is fair game.
Right.
Correct. That's a great way to put it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Okay. I think that's it. Thank you very much. So we have completed the list of people who want to testify on House Bill 2406. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2406, and when we're ready, we'll open the work session on House Bill 2406. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2406.
We need to adopt the amendments.
Sorry,
Mr.
Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2406.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2406. Is there any discussion of the motion? Any objections?
I do have a question.
Okay.
And it deals with Representative Lively's questions about, if the legislation says that, you have to be able to see into the vehicle, as I read it, does this legislation cover that, the intent of it? Because I don't think you can look and see inside the window. When you have the graphics, you can see out for safety, but you can't see in. I was just wondering whether the Dash 1s dealt with that issue or gave it clarity.
Well, I think it does say see into or out of. Perhaps Ms. Joyce can give us a little more clarity on how that might be defined, or how the department sees it, how they see into it or out of it.
Chair Reed and Representative Doherty, again, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. So what the current law, and as it continues in the Dash 1, you need to be able to see into and out of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And what the Dash 1 then does is remove the rear window from that requirement that you be able to see into and out of the vehicle. So it
just deals with the rear window.
For the rear window, there's no requirement that you be able to see into or out of the rear window.
Oh, okay.
With the dash.
Okay, Representative Murray.
Okay. So this would deal with Mr. Meeker's issue when he was pulled over by the Salem police.
Provided we don't know, but provided what he was dealing with was not on the windshield or the side wings or the side windows, forward or adjacent to the operator's seat. I think that's right.
Okay.
So the motion, it, Representative Davis.
Sorry to belabor the point, but thank you, Chair. I think, as I am reading this, the intent would be simply to align the law for passenger vehicles and other trucks with vans that don't have rear windows to begin with. A lot of work vans don't, for example, plumber's vans, things like that, don't even have rear windows. And then the example given by, I forgot his name.
Mr. Meeker,
of a pickup truck that has a load in the back and you can't see in or out anyway. That's how I interpret the change.
Certainly.
For what it's worth.
Certainly similar okay. Issue. Okay. So the motion is to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2406. Any objections to the motion? I don't see any. Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2406 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved House Bill 2406 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I don't see any objections. I don't see any. Motion carries. House Bill 2406 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. We'll ask Representative Olson to carry and close the work session on House Bill 2406. Open a work session, or a public hearing on House Bill 2041. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2041-1 allows employee of Department of State Police, County Sheriff's Office, or City Police Department to request the Department of Transportation use address of employee's employer instead of employee's residential address on records maintained by the department. Once again, we are in possession of both the fiscal and revenue impact statements, and you have the dash ones, if I believe.
Thank you. And who do we have on?
Kevin Campbell.
Mr. Campbell, please. There it is. Fuller is gone here. Okay. You're on your own, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Fuller has abandoned you.
Yes, no worries. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2041 with the Dash 1 amendments. And although we did not request the bill initially, we're very interested in it, and it looks like I'm it today in order to testify in favor of it.
It's all on you.
I will try to make this very brief because I think this is a very easy bill in terms of its intent. There is already language in statute right now that allows individuals to have as the address on record with the Department of Transportation, not their personal address, but instead for the address of the public agency employing the eligible employee. And you can imagine why. It's in incidences where your profession by its nature puts you in a situation where having your personal address on record creates a potential hazard to you or to your family. The amendment and the reason for this bill is simple. It's designed to add police officers and those that are involved in public safety. But the original bill, as it was outlined, makes the reference to state police officers, county sheriffs, and police or officers of a city police department. And in our state, we have a number of police departments that are not city police departments. So a good example of that is the Port of Portland Police Department. It is a fully operational police department, but it's a port police department. We also have the University of Oregon Police Department and others. And so the amendment simply takes our definition of police agency in all its forms in that one ORS that's referenced in the Dash 1 amendments and makes that the applicable statute. It is the broader definition so that we don't get stuck just applying this to a city police agency. So we hope the amendment takes care of that concern. I got a call immediately from the chief of the Port of Portland Police Department saying, hey, could we maybe be included along with the others in this? And so that is the purpose of the amendment. And hopefully I have adequately described the purpose of the bill as well. And I would be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions. Representative Doherty.
Okay. And so this could be a non-sworn part of the police department that deals a lot with criminals and this kind of thing? Because it says something who is employed by law enforcement unit as well.
Yeah.
would it not?
Chair Reed and Representative Doherty. It does in the amendment, if I've got it right in front of me, say whose duties include personal contact with criminal offenders. So anybody that does have a responsibility where they're interacting with a criminal offender would be included. And that, of course, is probably the reason for the bill in the first place, is the amendment, is that is really the danger to the employee potentially or their family in any situation where their personal information regarding address is available.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, so DOC, OIA, parole, officers.
Chair Reed and Representative Cameron, actually, the actual statute itself has a long list of people that are included. And so already included in this measure are people that participate in parole and probation and other Department of Corrections functions. So they're already included in the law. And interestingly enough, for some reason, police officers, state, county, city, and other police departments I've mentioned were not included. And so the goal is to include them this time.
So that prompts a question for me. In the original bill, and we don't have to get too far into the details here, it does have a police officer as defined in ORS 801-395. We've now, if we adopt the amendment, we're going to broaden it beyond that. So police officer, at least as I read it, there's an attempt there, and we're saying with the amendment we're going to broaden beyond police officer, right?
Chair Reed and members of the committee, the reference to police officer there, I think, is the key. So the ORS there is not the broadly considered ORS. And so this is a whole new category of folks. So I think that police officer definition is very narrow.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell, I'm really sorry that you have to be sitting there when I hit you with this kind of a question. Actually, it's more of a comment, but to see if you have any information that you might want to add. The public records exemption statutes are many and varied. Judges, for example, are exempt, but families of police officers or families of judges and families of other exempt persons, exempt from disclosure, address disclosure, or personal information disclosure. One of my great irritations is that it's a tremendous burden on county clerks. There's actually a notebook about this thick, I was shown one at one time, of individual pages of the different kinds of public records exemptions there are, whether you can withhold the address, the residential address, the phone number, and certain other bits of personal information, whether you withhold it for that person, for that person's immediate family, who's included in the immediate family, and then once they're no longer holding that position or that job, then how do you remove that exemption and start making them eligible for public disclosure again? So I'm going to support this. I think it's a great idea to make this apply to everyone it really ought to apply to. But is there any attempt yet to clean up a pretty messy and disjointed system of disclosures? And I should include email address and website and things like that. Sometimes people are remembering to list that, and sometimes they're not.
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson, now I am very sorry that I'm up here. that sounds like a difficult challenge, although I'll acknowledge that it's absolutely true. So I don't know that in my role with the police chiefs, we would probably be likely to take a lead on that, although I know that there are people that do care about that and are probably actively looking at how do you make this a more reasonable process. And part of the challenge is what we're doing today, which is we are constantly amending, and rightfully so, but every time we do, it creates an increased complexity, and you're adding to the responsibility to try to handle that. And so I do understand the burden that creates, and I do appreciate your consideration of this bill today. Thank you.
Representative Nathanson, I particularly appreciate that point. I can imagine that an accumulation of people in this category that may at some point no longer need to be in that category, and the importance of balancing transparency and access to public information. So that's a good point, and hopefully we'll have a chance to return to that question. Representative Gorsuch.
I was out on another matter.
did you talk then in terms of this broadening about non-sworn personnel versus sworn personnel?
Chair Reed and Representative Gorsuch, I did not in this regard. The actual bill talks about those who are sworn.
Yeah. Okay. And the reason I ask that is my wife worked for a long time for Portland Police. She was a non-sworn person, she and her colleagues in the identification division, and they rotated through and did the fingerprinting of folks in the Multnomah County Jail. Plus, there were non-sworn personnel from the county side who were taking the photographs, and so I just wondered if they would have, if there's a way to find, you know.
Well, the amendment.
I
saw that.
Representative Gorsuch, let me take that back.
Okay.
It actually does extend it to non-sworn who have the contact with those individuals.
Yeah. Okay, good, because, you know, they aren't sworn police officers, but they're very much identified by the folks that they're
in the plain reading of 9-2 of the amendment, it does say an employee whose duties include personal contact with criminal offenders.
Okay. So I think
I just wanted to clarify that.
That is the purpose. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Doherty.
Well, and actually, that's along the same lines, because I was reading the actual bill, and it is amazing how many people are covered under this. I mean, ESD employees and so on and so forth. But the very last part of it does clarify my concerns, where it talks about an employee employed by the state. Police were not included in that, other than the definition of a police officer. And so this does add to the employees, and so I feel very comfortable.
Okay. Okay. That's great.
That my question on sworn, non-sworn, is answered.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Fuller has joined you. You have backup now.
Oh, there you go.
Do you want to talk or move the bill? No, I'm just kidding.
you heard him, Mr. Fuller, right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, good bill should pass. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Oh, I love that testimony.
Any questions, Mr. Fuller?
Oh, and I support the amendments.
Very good. Thank you. I don't see any questions. I don't see anyone else who wants to testify on the bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2041 and open a work session on House Bill 2041.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill, the -1 amendments to House Bill 2041.
Thank you, Representative Benz. The -1 amendments to House Bill 2041. Is there any discussion? I don't see any. Are there any objections? I don't see the -1 amendments are adopted. Representative Benz.
Chair, I move House Bill 2041 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved House Bill 2041 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I don't see any. Any objections? I don't see any. Carries House Bill 2041 as amended goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Gorsuch, with some personal experience, will you carry the bill, please?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Gorsuch. Will carry. Close the work session on House Bill 2041 and open public hearing on House Bill 2301. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2301 establishes task force to review borrowing practices of public bodies and make recommendations about capacity and priorities for financing public property or activities. Stipulates 9-member task force shall include 2 appointees from the Senate, 1 member of the public, 2 members of the House of Representatives, 1 member from the public, 2 governor appointees, and 1 treasurer appointee. Sunsets task force on date of convening of 2015 regular legislative session. Clarifies definition of bond to eliminate conflict with provision related to financing agreements. Declares emergency effective upon passage. We are in possession of the fiscal statement and the -2 amendments.
Mr. Marks. And for anyone you'd like with you, I want to say while you're getting settled, on the staff manager summary, we're talking about borrowing practices as opposed to borrowing practices. and there we have identified some issues with the amendments that we have in front of us. So we're not going to be moving the bill today, but I think there are relatively minor issues to be fixed. So I wanted, Mr. Marks has been kind enough to be here to help us understand the context so we can uncover any issues with the general concept and then come back when we have the correct amendments. Mr. Marks.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Steve Marks, policy analyst with the Chief Operating Officer of State of Oregon. The -2 amendments to 2103 really provide a codification of the idea. 2301. Excuse me. Provide a process for codifying in statute the idea that the state should have a capital construction debt management and capacity planning process that strategically looks at how we spend our resources over time, particularly our debt resources, on infrastructure projects and the priorities that we place within that. I'd briefly work you through the sections of the bill. Section 1 is the expression of the policies of the state of Oregon around this, the need for infrastructure to support our economy. Importantly, it identifies the 10-year horizon here for this plan and the $5 billion of general fund and lottery funds that we expect to have. It calls for the state of Oregon to be a strategic investor and to optimize our investments as we go forward. Section 2 of the bill is the part that authorizes the Department of Administrative Services to create such a plan. In Section Sub 2 of Section 2 is really where we look at the financial requirements and the horizons that we plan underneath so that we have a sustainable basis for moving forward. It's within this section that the Treasurer has actually identified that we may have been overly specific, I think, in this, and that we should make sure that we put some deference here to the Debt Advisory Committee and their recommendations for sure. Beyond that, I would say we had a discussion with the Treasury about creating for them even a greater role, perhaps, in reviewing the plan that DAS puts together at the time.
I think that's well said. The only thing I would add to that is the conversation around making sure that level of specificity is appropriate. And a note, for example, on at the very last two lines of page 2, limiting new lottery-backed revenue debt to levels at which net proceeds exceed debt service costs by 3 to 4 times. Even that, we either should be less specific or actually specific. 3 to 4 is sort of, in my mind, kind of in the middle, which is not helpful. So that indeed is the area we will likely have another amendment to further refine.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And just I want to make sure that you see, and we have a letter for the record from Treasury staff that I'll make sure you have. It's not in front of you. I want to go to page 3, really section under B sub D really says then at that point that after you look at the fiduciary responsibilities and that capacity that we plan with under that over time that we should leverage our opportunities with other funds, capital planning. So I think the envisionment here is that as the general fund and lottery process of planning gets mature, that you'd be able to look at how those relate and how you could get efficiencies when you made plans with transportation funds or other capital funds of the state. In sub 3, we begin then to look at the categories of debt capacity planning. This really establishes 3 primary categories and then a 4th, which is more of reserving, innovation, and more flexible. But the primary 3 are education, state infrastructure, and regional and community economic development infrastructure. The next section at line 22, sub 4 there, begins to establish the goals under each one of those areas, under education, under state infrastructure, and then again under regional and community. So it says not only are those the categories, but here's sort of the goals as we look at prioritizing our spending within those categories. Or our, not our spending, our planning for debt capacity. Only the legislature does the spending through bonds. And then under Section 5, it really is authorizes the department to provide coordination for other agencies of the state. It provides authorization for the department to provide technical assistance to other public bodies and to those bodies that would be using public funds for projects. And then lastly, that we are not required to take any action if it's not funded.
Very good. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Any questions?
So, Kim. Thank you, Mr. Chair. $2 million for consulting?
Yes.
That's my question.
So, we have a number, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, we're establishing a new process this time. We haven't had one in the past. There are 2 professional services persons, and then in the consulting, dollars. You may have the impact statement in front of you. We have finance. Let me just get it in front of myself. We want to establish the part, the processes that we will use in working with other agencies to do the cross comparisons between the types of infrastructure we're doing. So what we wanted to do is provide the legislature with more information about the returns on investments between the types of legislature, sort of the scoring if you're making an investment in education or if you're making an investment in education. What are those comparatives? How do they look to you in terms of return on investment and what we're getting with value for our dollar? So we want to establish some cross-comparative analysis that's a part of this process when you look at infrastructure projects. The $350,000 will go to innovation finance pilot programs and consultation services. This is related to some of the discussion you heard on public and private partnerships and innovation finance. And there's other legislation, perhaps pending on this, that would advance that even greater, but this is to continue some of our piloting efforts to look at how we would establish those public-private partnerships and bring private financing and leverage our financing in the mix. There's $500,000 for technical assistance to counties. We have allocated within the governor's budget this time we did $20 million to the 10 regions of bonding capacity for flexible spending in those regions on the projects that the local region saw as vital to themselves. Now, that money is intended not just as a consideration in the use of that money for them is whether you combine it to other projects that are of higher importance in the region. But that is the flexible money. This consultation service money would help them plan for the use of their infrastructure money in the region and help them plan for those projects that would compete with the larger, we have in the budget, a $30 million community and regional economic priority fund. So it would help prepare projects that are moving forward and being planned. There's also a water development side of this. There's $10 million in that fund this time, I believe, within the budget. We would expect that to grow over time. So this is to buy the technical assistance for the planning for the projects that we would want the legislature to be able to consider so we'd have planned, efficient projects and clarity about what the benefits of those that infrastructure is. We have reserved $600,000 for participation, Oregon's participation in the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. This money and the expenditure of this money is contingent on the state of California and Washington contributing like sums to that service. And then we reserved about $154,000 for the establishment of helping the education area, the OEIB, and community and regional planning establish their prioritizations of infrastructure under the coordination of the master plan that would be provided.
All for me, or a redirect, I think you referred to as.
No, that was when someone needed clarification on the original question. You're asking another question.
Yeah,
that's still a follow-up.
Was there any discussion back at DAS about using existing resources, eliminating something we don't need to do anymore before we add a whole other level of staff? In other words, moving resources from what we've done in the past 10 or 15 years to something that we're looking at doing things differently, versus adding a whole other two positions plus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, we had some discussions about that. I will tell you that this discussion bloomed late in the development of the governor's budget. We had decided that there was recognized that there's going to be considerable debt capacity and a need to do planning. And at that point, we devoted general fund to making this mission happen in a short time to help us get a plan up and running. There have been suggestions, and you know, the department is going through a whole cost process looking at other processes. At the time, we just budgeted general fund to support this activity directly with the idea that there would be some consideration of the efficiencies that we could gain by putting it in the process in another way or funding it under a shared services model, much like those processes that Treasury uses when they finance it and do the financing of a bond. So there was thought, but I will say we put this in the budget. This planning process itself late. The executive order was issued in December, I believe, of last year.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The concept is a very interesting one, and one that calls out, I guess, why, what sort of damage the state sustained by not having had this in the past. Apparently there was something, because we haven't needed it until now, and now we do, apparently. So what is it that we've messed up in the past that we could have done better had we had this device in place?
Chair Reed, Representative Benz, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of people would answer that question quite differently. What I can tell you is that in every budget that we've been a part of developing, these capital requests come into the budget process very late. Some are developed more fully. There's a whole process in higher education for capital construction of buildings. So we have a real difference in the quality of the kinds of investments that are coming forward. And so what we don't have is a lot of order or either scrutiny as you might like in that process before they get delivered in the budget. Some projects come along are well developed. Others have come along because it's a bill in the legislature that isn't well developed, but we want to get started on it, right? And so we get some bonding put in place, and then we start planning for the project, right? So a lot of our projects are sort of retroactively planned. Some are well planned coming in from the initiation. So this would just provide us a more unitive way of looking at how we strategically want to use our capital investment. And there's not a patent, I don't think, on what that orderly process might look like, but the idea that we could have a more orderly strategic process is something certainly that we believe is well within our reach.
Would the risk of using a football analogy that doesn't quite work. For me, the attraction to this has always been that while we could certainly call an audible at the line of scrimmage, we ought to at least break the huddle with a play called. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the words strategic and legislature don't fit. And
not yet. A more perfect union and a more strategic legislature.
Now, a lot of optimism in that remark.
Yes.
It seems to me that my observation in the years I've been here has been that the best laid plans are quickly thrown in the trash depending upon who has the power to spend the money. And what I would fear is that this well-laid plan, a lot of money spent on it, would be thrown in the trash depending upon who has the power to bring whatever it is home that they want to bring home. And so I guess I need to know why and how this, well, this money being spent on what will be a good effort and one I think the state would benefit from if anybody would ever follow the thing. What is it that would suggest that anybody would follow it once all this careful thought has gone into place? And I like planning. It's a good idea, but politics.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I'll give you the best example we have of an ongoing planning process. You were just dealing with it, and it's Connect Oregon, right? We have moved that forward, even though it's not certain, right? We've moved forward a process that is getting increasingly strategic in the investment it makes over time because we've had that expectation. So I'm not saying that process is a perfect example, but that's a great example in Oregon of something that's moving us forward in the kinds of investments that we need to make in transportation infrastructure that's multimodal and alternative transit. So I think that possibility certainly exists for you in other areas within the state. If you think about the water capacity needs we have throughout Oregon, you can certainly see the establishment of a planning process to move water development and use projects by regions of the state forward over time in some orderly fashion, and that we have a necessity to do that given our water resource situations for the future. So there's best shot.
One of the things that I considered when we last talked about this a month or so ago was the collapsing, if you will, of 10 years of bonding capacity into a front-loaded plan, and then kind of a hope that we could do a bigger infrastructure project, but knowing full well it would require the cooperation of subsequent legislatures. And that seemed to make one wonder how you could do more than commit the resources that were available during the upcoming two-year biennium. So what is it your thought that this plan would somehow bind subsequent legislators? And if not, what good is the plan?
Chair, Representative Benz, I think I would just point to connect again. I mean, that's a process that is held up. We've had a way to look to our future through that. There is nothing that would bind the future legislature, I think, except the experience of those folks and the governance processes that we had, the quality of the governance processes and stakeholder involvement, and the creation of that expected spending blueprint, right? That's what will either hold and bind it together, because it's a well-done process. People see it, understand it. It is a lot of funding, and as you well know, every time we have an infrastructure debate around here, a lot of people get interested really fast. So I think there would be a strong interest in the development of a solid process. Whether it's five, whether we could pull it off, you're right, that's the challenge here. There's never certainty between biennials and the way we're constructed, but this gives us the best opportunity to do that and create better processes than we've had in the past.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I think that's the as far as we'll take it today. But again, for the benefit of the committee, the amendment that's before us, these dash twos are a good indication. I think they need a little further refinement. But I, for one, am interested in coming back probably sooner rather than later. So as you have additional thoughts, please let me know. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2301. Thank you, Steve. Before we go, we have one other bit of business. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to let Representative Gorsuch vote on 2406, House Bill 2406.
Thank you. Representative Benz asks for unanimous consent to suspend the rules and allow Representative Gorsuch to vote on House Bill 2406. Is there any objection to that? I don't see any. With that, the rules are suspended. Representative Gorsuch, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Gorsuch votes aye. And we'll
you too.
That's the end. We'll see you all on Monday.
That's the end.
Good weekend. For today.
Just the pause.
For today. Okay. Yeah.